previously.tv podcast network.
It's 2 days before Thanksgiving, and the York County Sheriff's Department has a double homicide on its hands.
Anytime you have a death, it's tragic, but when you couple that with the holidays, it ramps it up.
It's the most murdery time of the year. If you think my intro is tacky, wait until you get a load of the Homicide for the Holidays episode titles. All of this and Team Foxcatcher again. It's The Blotter Presents, episode 34. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to The Blotter Presents. This is episode 34, where I guess we'll be giving new meaning to the term surviving the holidays. I'm your host, Sarah D. Bunting, and I am joined this time by first-time guest, Stephanie Kangaroo. Hello, Stephanie.
Hey, Sarah. Hi, everybody.
Let's just get right into our most wanted section, where we will be discussing Homicide for the Holidays, a series on Oxygen that apparently is now in its second season. I had never even heard of this program before. I don't know about you. Stephanie, had you heard of this?
I had not.
The episode that we are discussing in the main is the first episode of the second season called Thanksgiving.
Best title.
Yeah, and I should add that the promo card for the show that shows up like on your DVR when you're recording it is it's like feet in a morgue with a toe tag, but the toe tag is a gift tag with some holly on it. I don't know whether to admire how just like blatantly crass that is or be offended. I guess I'll go with admire.
Oh, I'm all in. I think if you're not someone who's into the Hallmark Channel movies, but you're still a festive person, like this is what you want on in the background, like as you're wrapping gifts and having cocoa. Like it's murdery, but it's just the borderline of like light murdery. Like they don't go into all the psychological details. So it's festive without being over the top.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely not prestige programming, but I actually found it very entertaining occasionally for what I'm sure are inadvertent reasons. Let me just do a quick case synopsis of season 2, episode 1, Thanksgiving. 2 days before Thanksgiving in 1997, Earl and Terry Robertson are brutally slain in their Rock Hill, South Carolina home, and their adult sons are nowhere to be found. Are Chip and Jimmy victims too, or did the senior Robinsons get Menendezed? Like I said, I'm also all in on the tackiness. Just use Menendez as a verb. In clip 2, we're going to hear a little bit about what might have been a motivation for these killings. Here we go.
Thanksgiving in Rock Hill is fun. I remember Earl and Jimmy right there, me in the yard preparing for Thanksgiving, trimming the hedges, raking leaves, and Terry was breaking out the good china, all the furniture was being polished. They wanted everything to be just right for Thanksgiving.
Stephanie, I don't know what your personal definition of fun is, but those sound like chores to me. Am I
Complete
mistaken?
Chores. Absolute chores.
Yeah.
But Terry's a homemaker, and that's what they do in Rock Hill, South Carolina. And I will say, I love that these are reenactments because you see them like, you know, polishing the silverware and setting the table to match. We just heard the neighbor's description of it. But then if you look at, spoiler alert, there are crime scene photos, you know, in the show. It's the complete opposite. It's like, you know, your standard table with like paper goods and stuff. And it's more realistic, I think.
Yeah. The reenactment, like someone really went all out. Someone who really wanted to be on like Trading Spaces or something.
Uh-huh.
Just really went all out in the reenactment. And then it's quite a bit more you know, frumpy and normal in the crime scene photos. There's also a very sad photo that they keep. It's nothing too gory if you're someone who's concerned about that. But there is one photo of Terry Robertson's foot, like, sticking out very small and sad from under a bed that I thought was just quite heartbreaking. I should come up with a like term for this, like the how long it takes you to finally break down and Google the case that they're covering, because it seems obvious what the outcome is and they're taking forever to get to it. I managed not to do it this time, but only because I wanted to feel superior to literally everyone involved in this program for not immediately seeing that it was the kid. Spoiler, it was the kid. But let's hear clip three.
Right now, you're in a holiday period. And this should be a time of joy, a time of family gatherings and good times. And you would wonder, is there a connection for Thanksgiving? Why did it happen in that manner?
Investigators question if these murders could be connected to the holiday or if they're the result of a random robbery gone bad. With the killer still on the loose, investigators race to locate Jimmy and Chip.
Okay, couple notes. First of all, why now? Really? Your family's perfect and awesome and no one ever fights then, detective? Second of all, my dad's brothers are named Jimmy and Chip, so that was a little weird. Watching this episode, when did you have it clocked that it was Jimmy who did this?
I think pretty much right around this clip, actually, which is about maybe 10 minutes into the episode. It's like a 40-minute episode, so it's not long. Definitely the Menendez brothers, you know, are top of mind because they just had their special. But it was not hard or nuanced, you know, in terms of suspense. At one point, they're talking about how, you know, Earl, who is the dad, his mom's coming for the holidays. And I was like actively rooting at some point for the, you know, surprise twist. It was the grandma who committed the murder just for like some sort of, you know, like maybe they were all in it together kind of deal. The only real question, I think, or point of suspense, and it's still not kind of resolved in the episode, is, you know, was it both brothers or was it just Jimmy, who's the brother who ends up living at home in the parents' basement?
Yeah. And that was a lead that they buried pretty well, that actually he was living in their home because he had done time for theft, I think, and also had been doing a lot of drugs and had been struggling with that. Chip was an Ivy League student. He was attending Penn at the time. And I also am fascinated as to what his actual involvement was there. We will link in the show notes to a piece that came out. Like, Jimmy is on death row, and periodically there's a development in his case. And there was this editorial written in some paper that just was throwing extreme shade on what a psycho he is. And also that he's really dumb. We will get into that in later clips. But first, I'm going to play clip four.
All you know at this point as an investigator is that Meredith apparently had been at that house. Her car was there, but she wasn't. They don't know where she went or why she went there, whether she left voluntarily, whether she is another victim who hasn't been found yet.
Well, you do know, because she's Jimmy's girlfriend. She parked her Honda all askew, like across the street. And Jimmy tried to make it look like a robbery, but broke the glass from the inside out. Like, I'm pretty sure
my
that
favorite dumb mistake.
I mean,
of all time.
You never watch CSI in a hotel, really?
Or isn't that the famous JonBenet, you know, kind of tip? That the window there too was broken from the inside. And that's what I immediately thought of, probably because of also of the, you know, seasonal timing.
Oh yeah. Good point.
Yeah.
This, a master criminal, this guy was not, certainly his co-conspirator, also not a master criminal. He did some things right, but then basically did everything else wrong. And I believe was under the influence of 10 times the recommended dosage of Ritalin.
Which he snorted.
Yeah.
Right? With Meredith. So it wasn't even that they just, you know, were taking prescription and were abusing them. They were hardcore snorting this stuff. And so paranoia there just is extreme.
Yeah. And apparently it wasn't helping his focus at 10 times the rate of the normal dosage, as we'll hear in clip 5.
He puts socks on his hands and he picks up a knife and a hammer and goes into his mother's bedroom.
Meredith relayed the fact that she was downstairs. She heard some horrific yelling and screaming. Terry was yelling, "Why, Jimmy? Why are you doing this?" And it was so disturbing to her that she would cover up her ears while this was going on and was going, "La, la, 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 la," so she couldn't hear the screams of desperation coming from Terry.
So, yeah, he put socks on his hands so he wouldn't get prints on the weapons, but he does this with a witness. He breaks the window incorrectly. And then he, you know, drives directly north to go get Chip, takes 95. And would you like to talk a little bit about our next clip?
Takes 95. He's using his dad's credit card, which he's stolen. So the police are totally on to where he's going. And they decide that, you know, somewhere along the way, he's going to drop off his bag of discarded murder clothes, which is when the police find this.
The trash bag is intact, and inside is a treasure trove of evidence.
We had knife, we had claw hammer, we had ball bat, we had bloody clothes.
There were socks. There was some blood on some socks that Jimmy had worn to try to hide fingerprints, basically. The t-shirt that Jimmy was wearing, bloodstain, and it had his image on it. It had Jimmy's face.
I mean, never
much
like
more obvious.
That is the most, I mean, first of all, that you're wearing a t-shirt that has like a family photo of you screen printed on it to kill your parents.
Well, in the reenactment, it is literally just a photo of the guy. I assume it's the guy. You don't really get to see it up close. Of the guy, like the reenactor, like a smiling, like profile picture. Like it's not even a family photo. It's just his face.
It's like his yearbook.
So, yeah.
Which, whatever photo it was, that you are wearing a photo of yourself to kill your parents is next level something. I'm not.
It's the one part of the episode where it got to be like, oh, this is creepy. Like, this isn't, you know, just a lighthearted, fun, like, true crime show now. Like, this is where, to me, that it was the one moment where it was like, this is a little too much. Like, there's something wrong. I mean, aside from the fact that it's a show about murder, there's something's off with this guy.
Yeah, for sure. That at a certain point, you're like, well, he got frustrated and maybe the drugs took over his rational mind and so on. But like when you hear that detail about the t-shirt, you're like, that boy is not right.
Yeah.
And on top, but at the same time, this is where I was like openly laughing at him because never mind the t-shirt and then you throw it away, and when they find it, it's covered in blood, and it's your face. Even if that weren't in there, try to take maybe not the most obvious road, like literally any road, but 95 would do it. Try 81. I don't know. That's a thing. Or try a little blue highway, and try splitting the stuff up and putting it in different places, like behind restaurants, or
try using cash and not a credit card where the police can track you.
Try putting a hood or anything over your face so you won't be recognized.
Yeah.
Try anything. Nothing was tried. Yeah. And I just have to wonder, I don't know, I'd sort of like to dig into the case more and like just see if he ever offered any rationale for the utter like escape fail. Because it's really over the top. Although, This is someone who sends Christmas cards to the prosecutor who put him on death row. So
I kind of loved that.
Yeah. I mean, again,
like part of me thinks that that's a part of genius.
Yeah.
In a weird way. And something's obviously off. But that part to me was like almost like a show of control.
Well, or if you're going to be evil, like I can just see him being like, well, I'm evil.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure he's guided by any rationale.
I mean, I think the show presents like, you know, the actual murder rationale as being he was in it for the money. His parents are rich. He thought his dad was, you know, going to blow a bunch of money by investing in a golf course and cutting him off. And so there's kind of a rationale up until the point where you find out, okay, he's snorting all this Ritalin. He's got this girlfriend. He's living in his parents' basement. He's wearing shirts with his face on them. And he also calls his brother, and it's implied that Chip is like kind of in on it and gives approval or is at least aware of Jimmy's plan and doesn't do anything to stop him. And so I kind of wonder if that played into how dumb the escape route is, if they were going to try to Menendez their way out of, you know, oh, well, we're just brothers and we're just getting together for the holidays. And oh no, our parents are murdered. I guess we'll just spend all of their money together. I wonder if some sort of that level of planning was in their mind, but they were just too dumb to execute it.
I don't know. Like you could argue that, you know, Chip went to Penn and he could have, okay. Lyle Menendez went to Princeton. President Trump went to Penn. Like, I don't think being an Ivy League student means you're going to get away with murder. I mean, you know, war crimes. Sure. Hey, Donald Rumsfeld. I see you. But yeah, I am very interested to know because Meredith Moon got a lot of time for being a conspirator after the fact, I guess, accessory after the fact. She seemed just like, I don't know, overmatched by the situation and not, I don't think I would have slapped her with that much time. Although, you know, she probably knew what was going to happen and did nothing to stop it. But then as far as I can tell, Chip never did a day in jail. So
Chip did. Not for the crime, though. I did some Googling.
Oh, that's right.
Like you after. He also had a drug problem later in life and did some time and subsequently apparently was in touch with Jimmy when they were, you know, in jail and up to a certain point. And then somewhere along the line that I couldn't find by Googling, I'm not sure if they no longer talk or what happened, but Chip did time for drugs. I guess maybe got clean in jail. I'm not really sure. And moved out of Pennsylvania. And that's the last kind of tracking of Chip, whereas Jimmy got the death penalty for this. He's still on death row.
Yeah. Well, and he's around my age and they keep like, he's come pretty close and it's been stayed a couple of times, but he's also doing that Gary Gilmore thing where he's like, just kill me. It's fine. And then he'll change his mind or his attorneys are like, we can't actually make that happen for you. It's yeah. So, I mean, you know, like if he were in Texas, he would have gotten his wish probably. Or not. Like it's really hard to tell what's going on in this guy's mind because he doesn't think like we do. Let's hear clip 7 where a local journalist expounds upon that when Jimmy gets sentenced.
In 1999, Jimmy Robertson is found guilty and receives his sentence.
I find as an affirmative fact for the record that the death penalty in this case was warranted.
Jimmy stuck his fingers in his ears like this. Jimmy, his whole life had been one of those young guys who just said, if I don't hear it, it didn't happen. If I can't hear, they can't sentence me to death. It's a classic picture of the narcissist finally caught.
And they do run actual news footage of him like cringing and starting to sob and stuffing his fingers in his ears. And it's affecting, not in a way where you sympathize with him, but it's definitely like, I don't know if the family culture was like, emotionally abusive. I don't know if he was asked to polish some furniture and finally snapped. I don't know if he used to be a good boy and got into drugs. I don't know what happened, but something in his wiring is wrong.
Right.
That said, this was not an unenjoyable 42 minutes of TV. Like, I enjoyed sort of like feeling superior to either the investigators or the show. It was an interesting case to research, like, once the episode was over. And I mean, I don't know, like, Thanksgiving tackiness aside, I think this is not bad for Oxygen. This is not a bad show.
Right.
If it were on again, I would not rush to turn it off is where I would put myself with it. How about you?
Right. It's on my DVR and I'm comfortable with it there. I will probably at some point, you know, marathon. I think season one was about 4 episodes. I would assume 2 is about the same length, but I'm not really sure. Season one, by the way, also starts with the Thanksgiving episode, which I appreciate their inclusion of Thanksgiving. I feel like that's often left off of the holiday, you know, movie or TV special menu, I guess. It was interesting. I enjoyed it for 42 minutes. I liked that the lead detective sounded like Christopher Walken, which is specific to this episode, of course. But yeah, I will at some point get around, I think, to the rest of them. And I'm sure I will enjoy them and maybe even Google and hopefully, you know, find something interesting or curious, I guess, that I haven't heard of before.
Yeah, I thought they selected this case well. Once again, this is on Oxygen. It airs, new episodes drop Saturdays at 6. Okay.
Yeah.
But they're up pretty soon, depending on your cable provider situation. They're usually up on the website pretty soon after that. So yeah, cautious recommendation to have on while wrapping presents. Moving on to our cold case. I had the show Guilty Rich on my list to check out, and I'm not sure I made the right call in which episode I picked, but in our cold case today, we are looking at the murder of Dave Schultz by Team Fox catcher Jefe and official wrestling weirdo John DuPont. He killed Dave Schultz actually sort of around the holidays, New Year's. Literally everybody could have seen this coming and did. But money talks on the Philly main line, so John DuPont's bullshit walked for a while. Here is my second weird connection of the episode. DuPont went to the same prep school as my dad and his brothers.
Ooh.
Jimmy and Chip. I think he was in Chip's class. My dad was like, you know, I didn't know him well, but nobody did. He was an odd duck. Definitely weird. Not unpleasant. Just a weird guy.
It is shocking to me that he went to not homeschool.
Yeah. And I think maybe he was partly homeschooled, and then he was sent to Haverford and had been kind of under the care of his mother for, and just his mother, sitting at the opposite ends of that long dining room table for years and years, and just had not been socialized.
Yeah, socialized, really.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. How much other John DuPont material have you consumed, Stephanie?
Not a lot, but I think from what I've read, the one I have consumed, which is Netflix's Team Foxcatcher documentary, that seems like the best or most well-regarded of the DuPont
trilogy.
Trilogy, yeah,
I guess.
Yeah, I mean, there's been Netflix did the documentary. There was a 30 for 30, and then those are both documentaries. There's this special, well, not special, but episode, which is, of course, documentary. And then there's the Foxcatcher movie, which is somewhat fictional, with Steve Carell.
I have seen them all. And actually, our esteemed colleague Chris Huff wrote up both Team Foxcatcher and The Prince of Pennsylvania in a single piece. You can find that in our show notes, and it's on previously.tv if you search, like, under 30 for 30, should be there. He agreed that Team Foxcatcher was the best of the lot, and so would I. So this seems kind of extraneous. This is episode 3 of season 1 of Guilty Rich. But at the same time, I am fascinated by this guy. Clip number 8 is a pretty good illustration of how even before it really went pear-shaped with the drugs and like delusional paranoia, he was awkward at best.
Won't you come in?
For 4 years now, John had been hung up on a sport called modern pentathlon, and the national championships were about to be held right here on his estate.
Modern pentathlon includes fencing, swimming, show jumping, pistol shooting, and running. John aims to excel in all of them.
With those events, you have to have access to horses. Fencing is not your average man's sport. You have to be pretty wealthy.
And he has the cash to compete at a high level.
So when he got into pentathlon, he needed trading partners and he needed a training venue. So he turned Foxcatcher Farms into that. He built a 50-meter swimming pool so he could train there. He had stables. He hired the best fencing instructors to develop himself. So, he put everything into this.
When a DuPont wants, a DuPont goes out and gets.
Apparently, one of the things that DuPont wants is to walk around his giant swimming pool in a Speedo and a sweatshirt. And I kind of wanted him to stop doing that.
I wanted him to stop doing a lot of things. The first of which, have you ever just looked at someone and their smile is off? Like, you could tell that in this guy's head something is off. And it's probably the lack of socialization from when he was a kid, which is why it was shocking to me that he went to school. The ridiculous wealth, I'm sure, played a part of it. But all of this is in the home movies, right? Which is astonishing that there's such a library, really, of home movies of this guy, because he was obsessed with himself, in a sense, or his charities. But I wanted him to just not look at the camera. Because I couldn't stand looking at him.
Yeah, there was definitely there's like nothing behind the eyes. And whenever he's smiling, it's definitely just like a sort of mimicking of something that he has seen humans doing.
Yes.
And his lip is obviously going to stick to his top teeth the minute he decides to stop smiling. Yeah. I think, and there's also testimony about how the chauffeur's son had to be paid to be friends with him. And just like the extreme emotional austerity of this family, and his father took off when he was like 2. But yeah, I sometimes feel like the narration, he's easy to pity, and it's easy to forget that he like bought a lot of influence and bought a lot of leeway for abuse for himself. But the show, I think, definitely wants us to pity him.
Right. Well, it's interesting you say that, because I think every one of these commentators, there's his lawyers there, there's a journalist, as well as just some other people who've been around him or have known him through his various sports. They all still seem in their commentary of him to protect him.
Yeah.
Did you pick up on that?
Yeah. Or just like, yeah. I mean, they do seem like not defensive, but they do seem sort of eager to be like, well, you have to understand with John. And it's like, well, do you? I don't actually think I do have to sympathize with this person, particularly since there were numerous reports of him being a weirdo in like at least a misdemeanor kind of way that local cops failed to do anything about, because he bought them all their bulletproof vests. He like lent them his helicopter, and they just weren't prepared to do anything. So the power of his money corrupted more than just him, and apparently some of these commentators. But yeah, like, all right, well, let's hear clip 9, because this is a pretty classic example of someone in a talking head interview maybe not seeing
not a womanizer,
the forest for the trees.
And You know, he was very...
No, he couldn't?
You know, very shy. Lynn Burke, who was a very beautiful girl, a 1960 Olympic backstroke champion. He'd always had a crush on her, named his helicopter after her, but really never maybe had the courage. And John was just strange. She told me that they'd go down to dinner, and at 8 o'clock, John would go to bed. Everybody in the house would have to go to bed. And then about 9 o'clock, when everybody thought John was asleep, they'd all go down in the kitchen with the mother and, you know, be telling jokes and having a great time. The budding romance.
I mean, that is a little sad, but also
weird.
Like, now we're supposed to give him credit for not being a womanizer? That guy? Come at.
Right. Well, the thing is, he kind of, in his own weird way, was, because he did subsequently get married to someone, arguably, you know, she was some sort of physical therapist because he's such, you know, an athlete, and I say that sarcastically, that he hurt his hand. He definitely abused his power as, you know, a rich white guy, and it extended to women. Like, there are, you know, clear-cut examples of domestic abuse, too. But because he was friends with the cops, you know, all he would do is brag about how he could get away with it, which is, you know, one of the biggest red flags of all time. But
yeah, but also definitely this documentary is like, and you see this in the other documentaries too, but I wouldn't say to as notable an extent, that they talk about, like, you know, there was concern about how much he was drinking. Well, all right, let's actually hear clip 10 and then I will continue that thought.
I don't know that John ever planned on or thought about what would happen after his mother passed away. What happened was that he, I think he probably drank more.
There was a certain amount of unease about his alcohol intake.
Just months later, one of DuPont's coaches on the Villanova team, Andre Metzger, makes a serious allegation.
He claimed that he was touched in a sexual way while on a massage table.
John DuPont vehemently denies the charges, and the case is settled out of court.
Case proceeded, the case got resolved, and that's pretty much it.
Whatever the truth of Metzger's allegations, DuPont is earning a reputation for abusing his position.
And for paying to make it go away, and for possibly hiding behind, I was drunk, I don't remember. I mean, I don't know. Like,
not even paying for it to go away, paying for it all, right? Because this allegation came when he was at the Villanova wrestling program, of which he was the head coach, having no experience, because he went to Villanova and said, hey, if you let me be head coach, I will build you a beautiful wrestling facility. This is like a situation he completely paid for and controlled.
Yeah, exactly. But then...
And there seems to be no shock about that.
Yeah. No, not really. I mean, clip 11, perfect example. This is one of the guys who was on the wrestling team. He has been in at least one of the other documentaries. And he's talking here about the deterioration of the relationship between DuPont and Mark Schultz, Dave's brother, of course, the sort of locus of the fictionalized movie with Steve Carell.
Like obsessed with Steve with Mark. He had, you know, Mark had to be around all the time, or he had to be in Mark's corner.
He complains to John that he's suffocating him. John, unused to criticism, doesn't take it well.
He's the type of guy, if he gets pissed off, he'll fire you, get rid of you. Everyone's replaceable, you know.
In 1989, tension between John and Mark reaches breaking point, and Mark Schultz leaves the team.
Always remember the golden rule. He who has gold makes the rules, you know.
Yeah. I mean, if you had to take one clip that sort of summarized this entire hour of TV, that's pretty much it. That, I would say, is the sort of overarching crime here, is that as long as there was a lot of money flowing towards people, they were willing to look the other way, which, not a new story, but it's interesting how much benefit of the doubt he gets for maybe having a touch of the spectrum.
I mean, it's so much of this whole story. It's so easy, I think, to get wrapped up in John, which, you know, you could, and people have written, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of thoughts about him and how weird he is. But also, the clip we just heard, it was talking about Mark Schultz. And of course, the guy he murdered is Dave Schultz, Mark's brother. And so they never were on the farm or this team Foxcatcher training location together at the same time. And my biggest question was, you know, how does Mark not tell his brother Dave, hey, you know, this guy, he's weird, and I'm actually moving off the farm because I think he's so weird.
Yeah.
Mark was there for a year.
Yeah. I feel like that is a sort of missing gap in the story, that like, as the stories of John DuPont came out, like first the Steve Carell movie, then, Prince of Pennsylvania, Chris Huff pointed out in his piece that Mark starts to diminish in his importance to the story in each successive telling, to the point where I was a little surprised they even mentioned him here. I think Dave Schultz did know, but he also was this super charismatic, friendly guy who was like the only one who could handle DuPont even a little by the end. So maybe he just thought, it's fine, I can handle it. I don't know.
And I don't know. Everyone who, you know, talks about Dave or in any of these talking heads, even, you know, John DuPont's lawyer says Dave is the guy. Dave's a great guy and he's charismatic and he's everyone's best friend. And he is a great person at being everyone's best friend. And the timing of Mark's leaving and Dave's coming is kind of interesting, because right around the time when it goes from John being a spoiled rich brat who does what he does because he knows he can get away with it, to legitimate examples of paranoia.
Yeah. Right? Like there comes a point when he's crossed the line between just being a garden variety rich dickhead and having a, like, clearly some kind of mental disease or defect, like staring at the walls and filming them. Should we hear clip 12? Because that's a pretty good,
yeah,
pretty good summary of how beyond the pale it had gotten by the end. Himself.
He was super paranoid. He looked different. He would look through you when you're talking to him, like something wasn't right.
There was weird stuff that struck us. You know, you'd walk through the house and all of a sudden you'd run into John and he'd be staring at the wall with a camera like this pointed at the wall. And he's like, well, there's a creature in the wall. You know, you don't see it. He's like, if you watch long enough, it'll move, Deuce. It'll move. And he's sitting there filming it.
He would have people out here with military x-ray machines, these security guys, right in the front yard. It would go down 50 feet and he could find if there's a tunnel. And they would just do that to pacify him.
As the delusions pile up and John sees threats everywhere, he employs a team of security guards.
He was out here with his security guys and they're all around the tree and they're pushing on it and like, and I'm like, what are you doing? And he said, I'm looking for a trigger button to open this tree up. I know there's a door here somewhere. And these guys are agreeing with him. I was like, why are you guys telling them this? I'm like, John, there's nothing there. And he goes, yeah, Robbie doesn't believe me. He doesn't believe me. I go, you're too paranoid. And he didn't need security. Anybody would have done anything for him around here. He had all the wrestlers.
Yeah, that's the thing, though. It's like, I think what got Dave Schultz killed is that DuPont had convinced himself that Dave Schultz was, like, plotting to kill him.
Yeah. I mean, it's possible. The guy whose voice we heard is Robbie, who's one of the wrestlers who was there. I think it's in the Team Foxcatcher documentary, not necessarily this Guilty Rich one. But he's talking about how Dave was building some sort of a mock bazooka for his son, which, you know, is a great idea. And John thought Dave was mocking him, and that kind of put him on
radar. I forgot about that. That was in this one.
Yeah.
I don't think I had seen that detail before either. That he made his kid this bazooka and like did everything to scale and painted it camo and everything. And John was like, fuck you. Like, oh, okay. the guy's not right. You gotta protect yourself, but not Dave's way, I guess.
well, not, I mean, it was just, I mean, and this isn't even the most gregarious example, right? Okay, you know, he's a rich dude. He's hiring all these security people to be around him. Whatever. He wants to waste his money poking at trees. Okay. At this point, he'd also pulled a gun on another wrestler, right? And he also decided the color black was, you know, not for him. So he fired all of his black athletes. Like, I mean, there's just so many, like, I mean, that detail is just like astonishing. And okay, you could say, oh, it was a different time. People didn't, you know, take moral stands or whatever. It was 1996. I mean, come on. Like, you know, that like this is not normal or acceptable behavior. Well, and yet they
forget
state.
Taking a moral stand. Like, the moral stand to take is to try to get him committed. Because he's altered and he's a danger to himself and other people. Like, never mind the like the racism. I don't think you can even call it racism because it's delusional. Like, he's ill.
Yeah, that's a good point.
I mean, there were a number of points where the heat was being turned up on the frogs, and the frogs should have leaped out and didn't. And
right.
Yeah, and but. Right to the very end of this hour where he has killed Dave and barricaded himself in the big house, the cops
nonchalantly, right? Like, by the way,
what's that?
He does this so nonchalantly, like in terms of how he's, oh, the search dude, he's flying helicopters, whatever. He just literally got in his car one day, drove, you know, down from his main house on this farm to Dave's house, shot Dave in front of his wife, and then drove back home.
Yeah.
It was the most nonchalant thing about everything.
I don't think he even got out of the car. Just like, get out of the car. Like, show the man you're killing some respect. Get all the way out of the car. No.
Yeah, no.
So the way that they got him out of his house, like, they knew that he had this entire arsenal because he lent half of it to them. So they have
had a tank.
Yeah. Like, literally had an APC. How? Why? All right. Whatever. So they turn the heat off, hoping that he will think the boiler is broken and need to come out and fix it, which is what happened. But, they seem pretty determined to bring the pathos even to this last bit of
police
John's
decide to use
life
the frigid
as a free
January
man
temperatures to their
clip.
Advantage. They turn off the heat to the main house. Hours go by, and the mansion grows cold while negotiations heat up.
But at one point, one of the negotiators, a young man, very good, he was speaking with DuPont, and DuPont wanted his heat turned back on.
He was actually burning in his fireplace a book that he had written entitled Never Give Up.
Yeah, apparently that actually happened. First of all, shout out to all the delicious Southern Pennsylvania accents in this. He wanted the heat turned back on. Like, oh, my people. But that little detail, like, yes, that is pathetic that his self-published book, Never Give Up, is going in the fireplace to keep him warm because he shot somebody and the cops are trying to literally freeze him out. But I don't know. Like, it's hard narratively because I think the fact that he is so odd and that there is this pathos, like this drive to just feel like a part of things and always having to buy that like companionship and camaraderie in every instance. Okay. Like that's sad and compelling, but I like narratively, it's like, you know, it is possible to be too like soft on the guy, I guess.
Yeah. I thought the way the psychologist, Peter Dietz, I think his name is, summed it up as real, or Park Dietz, summed it up as really good. John was a sad and sick dude. So he was mentally, you know, ill, obviously, but not enough, or it was proven in trial, not enough to not take responsibility. Like, there was something off and it should have been treated, but it wasn't. And there was enough of him logically there to know his actions were wrong.
Yeah. I mean, you don't barricade yourself in the house if you think that everything you did was justified and all cool.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. DuPont, of course, died in prison in 2010. I think one of these documentaries noted that like he actually seemed to like prison life pretty well. Like there was a structure to it, and I mean, communal living, that's really all he ever wanted, and now he's gotten it. But I don't know. I thought they were a little maybe soft on that. I agree with you, but qua show, I thought this was okay. I would watch this again, depending on the topic. I don't know if I would DVR this one, but depending on the topic, I thought the plummy narrator was perfect for this, like just very melodramatic and good. And it was just like, well, professionally well-built true crime.
Yeah. I thought the episode was like, the structure of the episode was really good. I love that they did so much of like back footage instead of reenactments. They had some, you know, cheesy reenactments in there too. And I'd be interested to see if it is something that extends to the rest of the series. But yeah, I think I would probably, you know, on a case by case about
that. Yeah. I mean, and not that I approved exactly of Steve Carell's like ship's prow of a prosthetic nose in that movie, but the guys they cast in these reenactments, not even close. Like, well, they're the right race. Okay. Like, not even close. You need to get someone with the schnoz. But yeah, case by case basis, for sure. All right, before we wrap this up for yet another episode, Stephanie, where else can listeners find you, and or do you have any other true crime to recommend?
I'm on Twitter at Stephanie Lenore. I would love to hear anyone's thoughts on any of the film for the holidays. I will be following those. As far as true crime, no, but if anyone has recommendations, I'd love to hear them.
All right. Well, perhaps on the booking sheet, you will find something to set your DVR for, because coming up on the blotter, John Ramos returns to talk about Jeffrey McDonald and Noel Crane in Final Vision. Kevin Flynn of Crime Writers On is going to talk about The Family I Had, and I will have a best of 2017 true crime TV recommendations list, and I hope you, the listeners, will help me out with it. You can do that by following us on Twitter at Blotter Presents. We're also Blotter Presents on Facebook. You can like us there and join the discussion. You can join the discussion anytime on our forums. That's previously.tv/forums. I'm Sarah D. Bunting. I'm on Twitter at Tomato Nation. And we will talk to you next time.
In a production of the Previously.tv podcast network.